history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you, seemingly ordinary Americans who have done extraordinary things on our behalf. And those are the kind of stories that should be told, right? We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their experiences so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take these journeys back in time, we learn so much. We are educated, we are entertained, and so frequently we leave inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. My plan today was to introduce you to an incredible World War II veteran named Bob Izumi, but we're going to save that for next time because of a development in the last week that many thought would never happen. The discovery of the cruiser USS Indianapolis 3.5 miles deep in the Pacific Ocean. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you've heard about the Indianapolis and its unique distinctions before. If you're a student of World War II history, you know that the Indy, on a secret mission in which it set speed records, delivered the components of the nuclear bomb to the island of Tinian at the end of July 1945. The bomb would be assembled there, loaded onto the Enola Gay, and dropped on Hiroshima, hastening the end of the war. But what people here in the U.S. did not know was that the ship that had delivered that crucial cargo had been sunk by a Japanese submarine. And that wasn't the worst of it. The torpedoed Indianapolis sank in less than 12 minutes. There was no distress call, and the Navy didn't know the ship had sunk until 3.5 days later, when a pilot named Chuck Gwynn was on a routine patrol flight and spotted some survivors floating in the water. By that time, it was too late for so many members of that 1,200-man crew. Approximately 900 had survived the torpedo attack, but over the days that followed, two-thirds of those survivors succumbed to several factors, the most famous of which is the worst shark attack in recorded history. Official Navy records say that 317 men survived all of it, and today we're going to hear from one of them, as well as the son of one of the 879 sailors who died in what ranks as the single greatest loss of life at sea in U.S. Navy history. Before we get to those special guests and get their take on this new development, let's hear briefly from the man who made it possible, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, whose research vessel Petrel made this find 2 years after a similar discovery, exploring the wreck of the Japanese battleship Musashi, which had been sunk by Allied forces during the Battle of Leyte Gulf in October 1944.
Well, we've done a number of these explorations to try to find sunken warships. So we try to do these both as really exciting examples of underwater archaeology and as tributes to the brave men that went down in these ships. Once we find a target on the bottom of the ocean, then we send down an ROV to go down to the bottom and take high-definition video of what we find. So we're looking forward, we're excited to do a video feed from the bottom of the ocean like we did with the Musashi to show everybody what the wreck looks like now.
So we can look forward to more from Paul Allen and his group, but the images released so far are breathtaking. I have some of those along with links to Paul Allen's site posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Allen's group is working closely with the Naval History and Heritage Command, including Dr. Richard Holver, a historian, who explains why the recent discovery of a log from an LST that had crossed paths with the Indy on that fateful day helped lead this team to a new location that past searchers had not previously considered.
All the paperwork is lost. There was no distress signal that went out. So basically, we had nothing but the recollections of the crew, the survivors. So it was really an imprecise location at the beginning. When Captain McVeigh was picked up, first thing he said, we were exactly as rooted. So he was saying they were exactly where they were supposed to be. So that is where the Navy position came from. Like, plugging all the data in, that's probably where Indianapolis should have been. But we don't have any of the supporting, you know, historical documents. Their deck logs were gone. All their records were gone. They spent 4 days in the water afterwards. A lot of the primary actors didn't live through it. So it's as a historian, there are a lot of missing pieces into that original sinking location. With LST-779, it's important to give you another data plot in that route. I mean, they reportedly were passed by Indianapolis around 1200, 1300, anywhere between 12 and 1400 on the day of the sinking, so about 11 hours before Indianapolis was sunk. So that gives you, if you can figure out where LST-779 was, that gives you another data point on that route that can give you a better idea.
It turned out to be the best idea. That clue moved the search grid further west from previous efforts and eventually right to that find, 3.5 miles deep. The photos released by Paul Allen's team show the ship's bell, some of the guns, and even the cruiser's number, 35, painted on the hull. Retired Rear Admiral Sam Cox, the director of the Naval History and Heritage Command, puts it in perspective.
I would prefer people to focus on the heroism and the valor of the crew, which actually began long before the ship was torpedoed and sunk. She had 10 battle stars in some of the most brutal combat throughout the entire course of the Pacific War. Even in a great tragedy like this one, there is valor, there is bravery, there are also lessons learned, in this case many of them, that need to be preserved and remembered. And in the case of this crew that made the ultimate sacrifice, you know, what they did needs to be remembered and not just for getting torpedoed and sunk. They were heroes.
And in a little bit, we're going to hear from the son of one of those heroes who lost his life in this tragedy. But if you really want to understand the whole story of this ship, I highly recommend the documentary that came out last year after a decade of dedication from director Sarah Vladek, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. You can watch it online. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And after listening to this trailer, I'm pretty sure you'll want to.
We were never allowed to tell the disaster.
I never talked to my wife or my kids for 25 years about this.
Indianapolis changed history. It was a ship that changed history, but the men paid the price.
As far as I'm concerned, it should be told what really happened out there in the water. I started into the Navy when I was 16, and I saw all 10 battles.
I saw the flag raised, Mount Suribachi.
And I personally helped load and unload components of the atomic bomb.
So on the 30th of July, we were hit by two torpedoes from a submarine and sunk.
Next thing I know, the ship's going right out from under me.
All I did was just walk over the side of the ship and into the water.
I didn't jump off the ship. The ship left me.
I opened my eyes under the water and I could see this ship was coming down on top of me.
I never did know how to swim, and the Navy never taught me how to swim.
And here's all these sharks going around. Come right across your legs like that.
It was chaos.
We couldn't understand why we weren't rescued.
A lot of them lost the will to live.
You look at their eyes, they're lost. You see people when they're not there.
Us guys decided, well, hell, that's where we're going to die.
Then there on that fourth day, I said, I hear a plane. And we began to splash water. We began to yell. We began to pray. Everything. And seemingly when he got to a point that had he gone any further, he would have gone over. But you know what he did? He made a dive.
How did I make it with nothing to eat, no water to drink, no sleep for 5 nights? Tell them the Lord was with me.
If somebody wrote this up as fiction, nobody would believe it happened.
People don't realize the politics in the armed forces.
All the headlines were about the captain being court-martialed.
Many a head should have rolled before they ever got to the captain.
It's the story that's not been told. Those don't want to remember. They don't want to recall this. It's too much. But I'm a dummy. I think it ought to be told.
And it is told so powerfully in that documentary, USS Indianapolis, The Legacy. We're going to hear what Indianapolis survivor Adolfo Celaya has to say about the ship's discovery. And if you're a longtime Hometown Heroes listener, you might remember him. His nickname is pretty distinctive, Harpo, because of the shaggy hair he had as a boy that evoked Harpo Marx. He convinced his father to sign for him and joined the Navy at the age of 17. Here's what Harpo experienced aboard the USS Indianapolis on July 30th, 1945.
I had gone to sleep down there below, but I had my crew chief, which came down looking for me and came over and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Why don't we go up on top deck? Our watch goes from 4 to 8. He said, "We can wake each other up." And so I went with him, and there wasn't a place upstairs that you could lay on. It was, all the sailors were upstairs because it was very hot. But I remember I always used to sleep with a blanket on. Everybody used to make fun of me because I did that, but I was got used to it, and my crew chief was laughing at when we went to bed, and that's where I was when the repeater hit. The big explosion happened right where I was at. The thing that saved me was a blanket that I had on, because when I woke up, there was no blanket. The fire had taken it off.
Were you burned at all?
I had burns on my legs and my hands where I had my hands out, but my hair was almost all gone. My eyelashes were gone there. So it was a pretty good-sized blast, and it killed a lot of sailors around me. The only thing that saved me, I think, was the blanket.
Well, this was just 4 days after you guys had gotten to Tinian with that important cargo.
Yeah.
Of course, and you still didn't know what that was. But what a way to wake up with your hair burned off, your eyebrows burned off, the blanket blown off of you. And that ship, this huge cruiser with 1,200 men on board, sunk in just 12 minutes?
12 minutes.
What was that 12 minutes like for you?
Well, I ran to the back of it, and then that's where I met with my friend Santos Peña. I didn't have a life jacket. I didn't have anything with me. In fact, I only had my T-shirt and my shorts. I didn't have shoes. I have nothing. And I told Santos, "I got to go down below, Santos, because I don't have a life jacket." And he said, "You can't." He said, "The ship is going down." I said, "I just came from the front of it." He said, "The whole front end is gone," he said. So I stayed with him. We both jumped off. When I hit the water, I hit something, and I thought I had hit Santos, and I thought I'd killed him, you know. So I didn't see Santos for 3 days. But after 3 days, we met up with another group, and here he was. I found him there. I saw the shark coming around. I mean, everybody would, when they say sharks, they start kicking and all that stuff. And I kind of stayed in the middle of everything, and except when I found Santos Peña, I went around and went over to look for him. But otherwise, they had nets hanging on there, but the nets were very rough on you because the ocean was pretty rough. So on the nets, I would get in between the nets and swim with it. And so that helped me quite a bit, too.
And I imagine the day that you were rescued in August of 1945 has to be the greatest day of your life, because none of the rest of the days would have happened if that day didn't happen. How did they get you out of there, and how great did that feel?
It's kind of a dazed deal. I mean, because they come down with the landing barges to pick you up with a hook, you know, and put you up in the landing barge. And then when they took you right up next to the ship that was going to put you in, which is the Bassett, the ocean was so rough that the landing barge was going up and down all the time. And so they had to put a kind of a hammock deal, you know, those deals that they put down, put you in there and tie you up, and then they haul you up to the top, you know. So I remember the sailors that took care of me, they were on this Bassett ship. Oh, they did a heck of a job. They gave me a little glass of water, probably about two swallows, and I told them, "No." I said, "Want more?" "No, no, you can't have it." So little by little, they got me back on.
They knew you couldn't handle that much, and yeah. I have to imagine you hadn't had anything to eat or drink for more than 3 days, right?
Oh, 4 days. Well, all the time I was there, I never had anything to eat or to drink.
So I imagine there had to be plenty of moments where you thought you were going to die.
I thought so.
How did you keep hope alive? I mean, were you out there praying? Were you trying to talk to other people?
Everybody was praying. I had them here in San Jose. My mother had gotten me a St. Anthony medal.
Mm-hmm.
And that medal that she gave me, I put it in my mouth. That metal stay was in my mouth all the time. I can remember that.
I want to get a sense of how tough it was for you to recover, because when your body goes through something like that, it does take a while to recover from those extreme circumstances. How long did it take you to get back to health?
About 4 months, three or four months. I spent 3 months in Long Beach Naval Hospital. And nowadays they call it something else, post-symptoms or whatever.
Post-traumatic stress disorder?
In those days, they called it, they said you were crazy or something like that, you know. they didn't bring up this the way they put it up now, you know.
No, and every time a veteran like Harpo Celaya shares transparently about those struggles, it has the potential to help another vet who's facing similar things. If you pull up our complete original interview with Harpo at hometownheroesradio.com, you'll hear how he returned to school after World War II and led the underdog, undersized team from Florence High School in Arizona to an improbable state championship in basketball in 1947. That story is captured in the book Harpo, War Survivor, Basketball Wizard by Charles Clemens. I have that linked for you, too. But when we come back, we're going to hear what Harpo has to say about his ship, the Indianapolis, being found 72 years after that incredible ordeal he survived. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and today's focus on the surprising news that the USS Indianapolis has been found 3.5 miles deep on the ocean floor, 72 years after it was sunk by a Japanese submarine. In a few minutes, we'll find out what that means for a man who was just 4 years old when his father was killed in that disaster. This news caught him completely by surprise. But what about the man you were just listening to, Indianapolis survivor Adolfo Harpo Celaya of Florence, Arizona? Here's how he found out this news more than 7 decades in the making.
Well, I had the pilot's wife, Norma Gwen, call me up. She's the one that found out first, I guess, and she called me up. And then after that, I started hearing from different people coming over to call me that they had found the ship.
And so when you say the pilot's wife, you're talking about the pilot who spotted all you guys still floating in the water.
That spotted us in the water, you know, that found us by accident.
Yeah, and if he hadn't seen you by accident, you wouldn't be talking right now.
Yeah, we wouldn't be talking, that's correct.
So he's the one who was responsible for saving your life, and now all these years later, his widow.
Yeah, everybody calls him the angel when they have the reunions up in Indianapolis. Yeah.
So the angel's widow is the one who told you that this ship had finally been found. What did that mean to you, to know that they found it? Is that significant for you?
Well, if you hadn't found us, I guess we would have never heard about the Indianapolis. I mean, still be a mystery, I guess.
And have you been seeing the photos coming out and everything?
Oh, yeah. But they showed it on TV and stuff like that. So I've seen a few of them. Not many of them, but I don't want to see too much of it anyway, so.
I mean, it's been 72 years, and the last time you were on that ship, it was right before you guys got torpedoed and sunk in such a hurry. But to see those photos, what you have seen now.
Just memories come back, and so everything kind of building up again, so you get excited and stuff like that. Then you start thinking how many of the shipmates went down with the ship, you know, and you start thinking about those things. So
when you say you don't know how much you want to look at, you're concerned about bad memories flooding back?
I saw where it showed the number of the ship and stuff like that. And I seen it also had the anchor on there and stuff like that. So I seen that. So when it comes out a little more, I guess I'll be looking at some more pictures and stuff like that.
I mean, it's been a few years now since the first time you and I talked about this. And I know a lot of things have happened since then. I mean, you've been part of a lot of different efforts to preserve the history of the Indianapolis, and you've seen the documentary come out, a major motion picture come out, books come out, and now this giant discovery. Have any of those experiences added to your perspective or changed the way you feel about all of it, or made any of it easier to deal with?
To me, it's the best thing that has come out is the documentary that has come out. That's the closest that I've seen that has been the best telling of how the survivors came out of it and all that stuff. And she interviewed quite a few survivors, so she did a very good job on doing the documentary on that, you know.
Is this something that you've thought about over the years? Maybe someday your ship would be found and that would mean something to you?
I never thought of that. I thought that they were going to stay down all the time. I mean, I never thought anybody would find it. When they first talked about it many years ago, they said it was in waters where it was probably about 6 miles down. And now that they've talked about it, they said that it wasn't that far down, that it was only about 3 miles down. So it was surprising to me that it wasn't that far.
Yeah, it's only about 3 miles down, but it's remarkably preserved. When you see those photos, can you picture being in that same spot on the ship when it was still floating?
Oh, yeah. It looks like, because I was on the tail end, so that when the ship went down, the tail end was the last one that went under. So I think the tail end is probably the farthest. Probably later on we'll have more photos of it.
The last I heard, there's only 19 of you survivors left.
Yeah, 19 of them, huh? So we're going down pretty fast, I guess.
Well, and there are so many others who are the families of those guys who didn't survive, who never got to hear their father's account.
And that's the ones that I think that I kind of feel kind of bad about it, because probably now that it's come out, the families of how many of those did go down with a ship or somebody, and how many of them were up in the water and were taken by sharks and stuff like that, you know. So there was never an actual count of how many went down and how many stayed up, you know. So they estimated, but I don't think they had the right amount, you know.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering if this discovery might have the potential to connect more people, to connect some of you survivors with the families of the fallen.
Now that they found the ship, it looks like they're getting more publicity and stuff like that on it. I remember when we first came out, when the war was over, there were very small little articles about it, you know, about the how many shipmates we had lost and stuff like that. But very small articles, and it wasn't very well known until most of these books were started coming out, you know, Fatal Voyage and all those other ones that came in. And now that Sarah has come out with this documentary has been up in Europe and stuff like that, being shown and everything.
And I remember the first time that we spoke years ago, you said that there were parts of this that still came back to you and bothered you. Does that still happen to you?
It's been bothering me for all the time. I mean, this doesn't go away. I mean, the Veterans Administration has sent so many psychiatrists and everybody to come over and talk to me and everything, and everyone's tried to say that, tried to forget, tried to do that, and you can't do that. That comes to you almost every day. You can't go to bed at night and not think about it. In the last 2 or 3 days, I haven't gone uptown or haven't gone into a place where one or two people come right up to me and say they saw it on TV, and, oh, my God, how can this happen and stuff like that, you know. It is getting up to the people now. They understand it a little bit more, or they hear about it more now. Where a few years ago, nobody seems to know anything about it, but all of a sudden, everybody seems to be realizing what had happened 72 years ago.
Does it ever get any easier for you?
Oh, no. Like, when this happened, I mean, it took a little longer to go to sleep for a couple of days, a couple of nights and stuff like that. But I guess in time, it'll go away a little bit. I don't think I'll ever forget until they put me on the ground.
Nope, and we all hope that day is a long way off. That is Adolfo Harpo Celaya of Florence, Arizona, where next month the post office on Main Street will be named in his honor. And in introducing our next guests, I hope I don't confuse you, and I hope you believe me, because it's a story that definitely dropped my jaw. After I first interviewed Harpo Celaya in 2010, and that conversation was posted on the internet, I heard from a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel in Alabama named Paul Leffler. Same name as mine, same spelling. He had stumbled across our interview when entering the search terms USS Indianapolis and Paul Leffler. And he used those search terms because his father, Paul E. Leffler Jr., was a 28-year-old seaman aboard the Indianapolis, who had survived many a battle aboard the Indy, but did not survive the ship's final mission. I spoke to Paul Leffler III on the phone at the time, and we've stayed connected online. When I heard the news about the Indy being found, naturally I thought of him and what it must mean for him and his family. And then I thought, well, you'd probably like to hear from him too. So we're joined now by the real Paul Leffler, Paul Leffler III of Fairhope, Alabama. And Paul, I know you were only 4 years old when this happened, but do you remember what it was like growing up as a boy with the knowledge that your father had been lost at sea?
Well, I have a vague memory of my father. And one of the memories is that when they were hit in the strike in Okinawa and they came back to San Francisco for repairs, he came home at that time. And I have a vivid memory of that time when he was here. We actually took a professional family photograph of the four of us. The family, he was not in uniform, he was in a suit, and I remember all that. And my grandfather had a house on Mobile Bay, and we went down there, and I do remember that part of it. Now, I had a really great childhood. My mother never remarried. I had a brother that was a year younger than me, and I really didn't have any emotion about my father until I became older and realized what my mother had gone through, which was the news was given to the families that she had been sunk the same day VJ Day was, when everybody was euphoric about the end of the war, and then she got this telegram that he was missing in action. And then I understood what kind of suffering that she went through for that to happen to her. So those were kind of the emotions that I had when I was growing up. And I never wanted her to have to go through anything like that again, were my feelings about it at the time.
And what about trying to learn more about your father or what he did on the ship or what happened to the ship? Was that something that you were always interested in, or did you stay away from it?
No, what happened was sometime in my 20s when I was, graduated from Citadel and had gone on active duty. I mean, my mother had always... We'd always had news clippings and that kind of thing around the house, you know, so I knew a lot about it, but I didn't seem that interested in it. I always considered him a hero and all that kind of thing, and that's why I think I went into the military. There was a doctor who was on the Indy who survived, and I think he wrote the first book that I'm aware of about the sinking, and my mother gave me the book. And once I read that book, that's when I became somewhat interested in it and what happened to the people who were on board. The fact that he was missing in action and nobody could ever tell my grandfather what happened to him was the main focus that I had, was that, you know, nobody could tell anything about him, what happened to him. He was on the bridge, his watch was over at midnight, and they were hit right after midnight. I had the last letter that he wrote my mother, and he wrote it from the ship when they had sailed from San Francisco to deliver the bomb. And in that letter, he talks about one of his good friends. Now, he was 28 years old, so his friend had to be older, around the same age, because his friend had a father who was a commander in the Navy. And they had dinner with this friend's father, who was the commander. And I located his name to see if he knew anything about my father, and he also did not survive. So there was really nothing that anybody could tell me, so I really didn't do much about it after that because nobody could tell me anything. Mm. So what happened was when the ship was discovered Saturday, it was just a huge surprise because I didn't know anybody was even looking for her. Mm. And I was so surprised and excited. I was getting ready to go pick up a sister-in-law from the Mobile airport who was coming in from Michigan. And I'm getting everything together, and I just received, I think it was on Facebook, and I walked out without my keys and locked myself out of the house.
Oh, no.
Because it was so exciting to me and so surprising. Those were the first emotions that I felt. And then on the way to the airport, you know, I felt this. They were all positive emotions, no negative emotions at all. I felt this euphoria that she had been discovered. I felt this joy. I was in awe. I was relieved. I was, all these things were running through me. And I think I'm different from a lot of the other people who were on the Indy because of the fact that my father was MIA and we never knew what happened to him. So to me, it was such a relief that the ship had been found, and that then you throw hope into that emotion because he may be still there. We never knew whether he got off the ship, whether he went down with the ship. And so that's why these emotions came to the surface. Mm. And I guess the biggest emotion that I now have is a gratitude and a gratefulness to Paul Allen for what he did to find the Indy. So that's basically what I'm feeling right now about all of it. And hopefully, you know, he's going to do something for the families, which he said in this Facebook page of his. So I'm interesting to look forward to see what's going to happen about that.
Yes, and we'll be eagerly waiting to find out, too, as we follow these new developments. We need to catch our final break, but I want to hear more about what this means to you and more about your father's legacy. He is Paul Leffler of Fairhope, Alabama, and you can feel in his voice how big a deal this is for him and surely for other families who lost loved ones on the USS Indianapolis 72 years ago. Like Paul, many of them didn't know a search for that legendary ship was underway, so the news from Paul Allen and his research vessel Petrel was a big surprise. I have links to Mr. Allen's website and all that direct source material for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where we're usually talking about things that happened 7 decades ago. But this week, we have an incredible new development to discuss, the discovery by the research vessel Petrel of the USS Indianapolis. 3.5 miles deep on the floor of the Philippine Sea, where it was sunk by the Japanese submarine I-58 on July 30, 1945. The research expedition was funded and spearheaded by billionaire Paul Allen, known as a co-founder of Microsoft, the owner of the Seattle Seahawks and Portland Trailblazers. You may not know that he's also a World War II history buff who has a hangar full of still airworthy World War II aircraft, or that Paul Allen would have never been born if his father, Kenneth Allen, hadn't survived an intense bombardment from German 88s on March 18, 1945, when he was setting up a ration point near the bridge over the Rhine in Remagen with the 501st Quartermaster Railhead Company. Kenneth Allen was awarded the Bronze Star for Valor for his actions that day. He died in 1983, but this week his son is a hero to 19 surviving crew members. of the USS Indianapolis, as well as the families of those who died in the U.S. Navy's most catastrophic loss 72 years ago. Let's get back now to Paul Loeffler III of Fairhope, Alabama. He was 4 years old when the USS Indianapolis disappeared. His father, Paul Loeffler Jr., listed as missing in action, and then, of course, presumed lost at sea, like nearly 900 others from that ship who were killed either during the sinking itself or in the 4 days that followed in shark-infested waters. Paul described for us the feeling of euphoria that came over him when he heard the news that his father's ship had finally been found. When we left off, you were telling us that you didn't even know people were looking for it. But over all these years, had you ever considered the possibility that it might be found, that a discovery like this could lead to more information, maybe, about your father?
Well, you know, I had no idea that people were looking for sunken warships. I don't know why I missed that. You know, I know I've found remains of pilots and soldiers and that kind of thing. I'm aware of all that, but I never knew that anybody was out there looking for sunken U.S. warships. Just didn't know about that. Mm-hmm. And I just figured, you know, I'd go to my grave at some point, not knowing that I feel at peace because we know where the ship is now. And I don't know how long DNA survives. I think sometimes it survives for 8 million years if it's protected. So his DNA is probably somewhere on there, and we share the same DNA, so that brings me a semblance of peace about all of this.
Sure. And I don't know if you have an answer for this or not, but when you say you didn't know what happened to him, I mean, what you mean is his watch was over, so you don't know where he went from there. Was he above deck or below deck when they were hit? Did he get off the ship? Was he in the water? Did he get eaten by sharks, as so many did in that disaster? Or was he below deck and somehow still on that ship? And I guess it's conceivable that his dog tags or other possessions of his could potentially be recovered down there.
Yeah, those are all the questions that are out there that aren't answered. As I said, he was a seaman. He was the quartermaster on the bridge, and his watch was over at midnight. Now, I know that his quarters were below deck, but my mother told me that he used to sleep. It was so hot in that part of the Pacific that a lot of the sailors would sleep on deck, which he would also do. So we don't know, as I said, whether he was still there. He was going below. He was below where he was when they were hit. So, as you say, the dog tags and that kind of thing, hopefully they'll find some things. And I don't have any idea if they can actually recover things from the Indy or if the Navy would allow that to happen. I don't know how that would work out. What I am looking forward to, if Alan puts these families together, is meeting some of these people, because there's a lot going on Facebook right now on Paul Allen's Facebook page. People are commenting to me, and I'm commenting back to them, and that seems to be one of the main themes, is him putting us together somehow and us meeting each other.
Yeah.
There are people like me whose fathers were lost that are around my age.
Yeah, and you mentioned some of the things specifically you had done to try to track down information, the meeting he had had in San Francisco and finding that other sailor had also died in this disaster. But one thing you've never done is gone to any of the reunions of the survivors or really had much contact with other families who lost people there, right?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, as I said, nobody could tell anybody anything about Paul Loeffler. There was actually a survivor who lived in Mobile. He was from Mississippi. And, you know, a lot of these guys were 18, 19 years old, and my dad was 28. And, you know, I talked to the guy from Mississippi who was living in Mobile, and he, you know, he couldn't tell me anything. And my grandfather was never able to find out anything. And one of the things I thought about during the years, maybe some guys knew what happened to my dad, but they didn't want to say.
Right.
I understand what I mean by that. They just didn't want to tell the story. So who knows, you know?
Mm.
But I'm just happy that she's been found, and I hope it's not something that is a negative emotion for some people. I think people ought to look at it as a very positive thing, and knowing that she's found and where she rests in the ocean. And, you know, it's an honorable grave for those sailors that didn't make it.
And I don't want to create a situation where I'm asking you to set expectations or set yourself up for being let down. But is there something that you've thought about that could potentially come of this that would be like a dream come true for you?
Well, you know, I don't know what the plans are, but if we could go to the site where the coordinates are on the Pacific, I mean, that would be my dream come true if you want to look at it that way. Mm. Actually, site above where the ship is, that would be something that I would do. On Facebook, somebody commented, maybe we can charter a boat. You know, somebody put that. I'm thinking that'd be a huge, huge, huge expense that people wouldn't be able to pay for. But somehow, if we could all get out there, meet at Guam or someplace like that, I think that would be a wonderful event.
Well, I certainly wouldn't put it past Paul Allen to put something like that together. Mr. Allen, by the way, through his Vulcan Productions, has preserved the stories of hundreds of World War II veterans on video. Those Chronicles of Courage are searchable online, and I have a link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Who knows? Maybe we'll get to sit down with Paul Allen sometime to get his perspective on why this history is so important and what kind of impact it can have on our future. But for the rest of the hour, we are privileged to hear from Paul Loeffler III. His father, Paul E. Loeffler Jr., was lost at sea 72 years ago on the Indianapolis, but Paul III would become an Army man, graduating from the Citadel in 1963 and going on to spend 28 years in the Army before retiring as a lieutenant colonel. And Paul, you said your father's Navy background was a motivating factor in your choosing to serve our country?
I believe that was the main impetus for me to join and to volunteer. There's an aside that I haven't told yet. My father was in the Navy. His younger brother parachuted into Normandy with the 101st Airborne. Now, when you look at those two people, statistically, my Uncle Robert should have been the one to perish in the war. But he survived, and my father did not. And my Uncle Robert told me stories about parachuting into Normandy and what they did and all that. And I had all that history from that side of it. So I think that's why I chose to go to a military college and receive a commission and follow through on that. And I've never had any regrets in any of that in my life. There's another interesting side to this story. If you've got a little bit of time, I can tell it.
Go for it.
Peter Benchley wrote the book Jaws. And I read the book. I was living in Chattanooga, Tennessee at the time. And in the book Jaws, there's a character named Paul Loeffler.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew at the time there were only 1,200 heads of households in the United States with the name Loeffler spelled with that spelling, the L-O-E-F-F-L-E-R. And I thought, well, that's a little bit weird, but I didn't think anything of it. The character owned a delicatessen in the town where the event took place. So read the book, enjoyed the book, and then the movie comes out. And Peter Benchley was the screenwriter for the movie. And in the movie, they have a scene where they're talking about the sinking of the Indianapolis. And I'm sitting there with the hair standing up on the back of my neck. Because my dad, Paul Loeffler, was on the Indy. Peter Benchley didn't mention the Indy in the book, but mentioned it in the movie. And Paul Loeffler was in the book, but not in the movie. So I contacted Peter Benchley. I was able to find him, find his information for New York, sent him a letter and all that. And he sent me a short little note about he had known many men of the sea. All characters in this story are fictitious. And I was just interested in how he came about, the name and all that kind of thing. Because Indy wasn't very well known back in those days.
Right.
And what I think is happened was he probably read the doctor's book. And in the back of that book are names of survivors and the names of the KIAs from the Indy. And I think he pulled my dad's name off the back of that book and used it in his book. And he got all that information when he was doing his research to write this book about Jaws, which is basically about sharks. It wasn't about the Indianapolis.
Right.
So that was just a little interesting aside and piqued my interest, you know, about it too. But after contacting someone and you don't really find out the information, then I let things drop at that point, move on.
Well, if he didn't pull it out of that index, it's a really eerie coincidence, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's why I was so interested in how it evolved, how the book evolved and the movie and the scene in the movie and all that. How did all that evolve, Mr. Benchley? You know? But I guess his little note that he wrote me back, it sounded like an attorney had probably written the thing. But I wasn't after anything. I was just curious.
Yeah, he's afraid of getting sued or something, huh?
Yeah, I just had curiosity about all of it.
I don't blame you. I want to thank you for your service to our country and for helping us understand something that no one else could, you know, what it was like to grow up with this knowledge and then the quest to learn about your dad. And now, as you described it, this euphoria of finding out that there might be more developments to come, that his ship has been found. I know that you've talked to a lot of people about your father over the years. You've done a lot of things to honor his legacy. What is his legacy in your mind? How do you articulate that? What does his memory and his story mean to you?
Well, he's part of that greatest generation who saved the United States, and I'm proud of that fact. I'm proud of the fact that he died in service of the United States. His photo with his medals and that kind of thing and something from President Truman about the ND and his name on that, signed by President Truman, is hanging in the Fairhope American Legion Hall in a place of honor. I saw that was done. At his school, University Military School in Mobile, where he graduated from in 1935, they also have that same photo of him, the World War II medals, and the President Truman document. So I've tried to keep his memory alive by doing things like that. And I'm just proud to be his son. And that's where I come from on that. At my family plot at Catholic Cemetery in Mobile, I do have a military headstone for him, even though he's not there. And it says, still at sea, which he is. He's still at sea. So that's the story. And here we are today, and it continues.
Yeah, who knows what the next chapter will bring. This discovery by Paul Allen and the research vessel Petrel has opened up a world of possibilities. That was Paul Loeffler III of Fairhope, Alabama. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find more information on him, his father, on Harpo Celaya, and on the USS Indianapolis, lost for 72 years but now found on the ocean floor. One more thing to mention before we sign off, Paul Allen and his Petrel team are not planning to recover any artifacts from the sunken ship, pointing out that the USS Indianapolis is property of the U.S. Navy and will remain undisturbed. It has been quite a week in light of this discovery, and there's no doubt that the connections that are taking place now between the 19 remaining survivors of the Indy and the families of those who died will create new breakthroughs as time marches on. One thing that I'm pretty sure you do as we listen to these veteran stories here on Hometown Heroes each week is to try to imagine yourself in the place of that veteran during World War II. What you would think, what you would feel, what you would do. Would you have survived? For many of you, like me, there's that awareness of, hey, I wouldn't even be here if my dad or grandpa or great-grandpa didn't make it home. And when it comes to appreciating the price of freedom and those who truly gave their last full measure of devotion for our sake, that sense of gratitude of how blessed we are is magnified even further when the one who paid that ultimate price carries the same first and last name that you do. That's how I'm feeling today, thankful that Army veteran Paul Loeffler III, sharing about his Navy hero, Paul Loeffler Jr., has this civilian Paul Loeffler understanding as clearly as ever that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.